oyez, oyez, the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 060845, Wagner and Brown Limited versus Jane Turner Shepherd, individually and as independent executrix of the estate of Sybil Turner, from Upshur County and the 6th Court of Appeals District. Justice Willett is not participating in that case. Docket number 060904, Guitar Holding Company, LP versus Hudspeth County Underground Water Conservation District number 1 et al. From Hudspeth County and the 8th Court of Appeals District. And 070147, N. Ray Kala Davis, Melvin Hirsch III, and Ann B. Hearn, which is an original proceeding. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each of these arguments, and we'll take a brief recess between the arguments. We should complete all of them well before noon. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 060845, Wagner and Brown Limited versus Jane Turner Shepherd.
May it please the court, Ms. Stokes will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 7 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, we're here today because the Court of Appeals got the law wrong. The court held that the termination of an oil and gas lease automatically terminates the lessor's participation in a separate unit agreement as a matter of law and without regard for the terms of either the lease or the agreement. Where the court went wrong was its failure to recognize that the unit agreement in this case is a contractual commitment of Shepherd's land to the unit, separate and distinct from the lease of her mineral interest to CW Resources. In that lease, the pooling clause, which is excerpted at tab B of your handout, the CW Resources was broadly authorized to pool, quote, all or any part of the lease premises or interest therein, and it defined lease premises as the land in which Shepherd held a mineral interest. And that's the Shepherd tract reflected on tab A of your handout. The clause also provided that any pooling could be terminated by the lessee upon absence or cessation of production in paying quantities. Under well-established Texas law, this clause had the effect of making CW Resources the agent of Shepherd in entering into the separate unit agreement. And that unit agreement, which is excerpted at tab C of your handout, Shepherd broadly pooled her leases and lands. Therefore, the unit agreement was a contractual commitment of Shepherd's land to the unit for so long as production continued from the unit. And the subsequent termination of the lease of her mineral interest to CW Resources could not and did not have any effect on her separate contractual commitment to the unit holders.
What is the current relationship between Wagner and Shepherd? Are they're no longer lessor and lessee, correct?
That's right, Your Honor. They're co-tenants under the law. Because we held leases on the remaining 7/8 interest in the Shepherd tract, we became co-tenants with her and her full 1/8 interest in the tract.
Explain how, if they're not lessor and lessee, how does the unit agreement, which seems to sort of presuppose that relationship, continue to remain in force?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that while the unit agreement was entered under the authority granted by the lease, it was a separate and distinct contract, and it was a contractual commitment entered into by CW Resources as her agent.
But the consideration failed, didn't it?
No, Your Honor. I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, I mean, if the reason the lease terminated is because of the failure to comply with the terms of the lease agreement, the royalties.
Right, and that lease has terminated, and we have paid her four times her share of production under the lease since that lease has terminated. But what we maintain she is not entitled is to nearly eight times her share of production of a non-pooled interest.
But it didn't terminate before the unit cessation agreement was signed.
That's right, Your Honor. The unit had already been signed and it had begun producing well before her lease terminated.
She's a co-tenant with the lessee because the lessee has other interests in the tract.
That's right, Your Honor.
But with respect to the well, I guess she's entitled to all of her 1/8 production after the expenses are repaid or something like
Well, we say that she's entitled to her pooled 1/8, which would be her proportionate, the proportion that her lease acreage bears to the unit times her 1/8.
Can the parties really agree to anything going in? Could they say, well, it'll terminate if any lease terminates? Or
yes, Your Honor. The treatises do say that there have been lease provisions that pooling will last only as long as the lease. And she could have negotiated such a provision in this case. The evidence showed that she was a lawyer. She was represented by a lawyer at the time the lease was negotiated, and that she negotiated a 4-page addendum to our form lease that extracted several concessions from the lessee. So she could have done that in this case. Instead, we have a provision that that pooling was effective as long as production from the unit.
And you think the terms of the agreement provide the exclusive means for terminating the unit?
Yes, Your Honor. I do believe that we need to enforce the terms of the agreement as written.
Seems like the commentators are relatively uniform against the way you wish us to interpret this transaction. Is that
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree with that. A few commentators have spoken about this, but the primary one who has is Kramer and Martin, who has a treatise on pooling. And I believe that they reject the type of automatic termination rule announced by the Court of Appeals in this case. They say that all the circumstances at the time of termination have to be considered, and that the lessor should be continued to be bound by the pooling agreement if she has already benefited from pooling in the form of production that she would not have otherwise obtained. Here, it's undisputed that the wells would not have been drilled on her tract but for the unit agreement. So she has obtained production as a result of the unit than the pooling that she would not otherwise have gotten.
She's being paid more out of the operator's share, is that true?
Yes, Your Honor. The producer is having to pay more than the proportionate share of the unit production than they had bargained for.
So the other, in the non-producing tract, their royalty interests have not been reduced as a result of this.
Well, not under this particular. Well, they were not parties to this case, and so that the record really doesn't reflect how their shares have been affected in this case.
This would cut both ways. I mean, you might want to stay in the pool. You might want to get out of the pool.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. The Court of Appeals rule is so broad, and with its derogation of the terms of an agreement, it could apply to a situation where Shepherd owned an interest in a non-producing tract, and there her interest would be automatically withdrawn from the unit. And I would submit in that situation, she would argue that was unfair to her and that the rule shouldn't be as such. But the fact that she happens to own the interest in the producing tract here shouldn't dictate the policy.
So if the shoe was on the other foot, if because apparently this lease, your client could terminate at any time by just stop paying.
That's right, Your Honor. Well, that's right. And
if they stopped paying for 120 days, the lease was over, so it was really terminable at will on their side.
Right.
And if they had terminated the lease, she could still demand payment from the pool?
Yes. Our position is that she would still be bound by the pool and that we would pay her pooled interest.
Not just bound, but benefit.
I'm sorry, you're talking about where the wells were not on her tract. Exactly, Your Honor, that she would benefit in that situation and that we would, our position is that the pooling would continue in that situation as well. Now, although there's little law on the issue of the effect of a constituent lease termination on a separate unit agreement, I think what law there is out there supports continued pooling in this case. The Fort Worth Court of Appeals, in its Ladd Petroleum versus Eagle Oil and Gas case that we cite at page 10 of our brief, held that the termination of leases on the only producing tract in the unit did not in and of itself terminate the unit. The Ninth Circuit, in its 1961 opinion in Stump versus Fidelity Gas, held that the termination of the plaintiff's lease did not automatically withdraw the plaintiff's lands from the producing unit, which the plaintiff had authorized the lessee to sign as agent during the term of the lease. And again, the treatise that I just discussed. I think the common thing.
Williams Meyer seems to go the other way.
does it?
Well, Williams and Myers has really just a single sentence that I would submit is ambiguous, and they don't cite any law or other authority for that proposition. And as we noted in our brief, Williams and Myers is now edited by Kramer and Martin.
Is the linchpin of your argument, I'm sorry,
divided on this? Or?
Well, like I say, I think where Kramer and Martin actually studies the issue and reflects upon it, they would support pooling in this interest, and there is a throwaway sentence that I think is ambiguous in Williams and Myers.
Kramer and Martin, you say, supports your view based on an agency arrangement?
No, Your Honor. I think that I think they recognize that the agency theory is one way of looking at it. They don't endorse it, but they do say in the situation that the unit is already producing and the former lessor has already benefited from the pooling, that they ought to remain bound. But Stumpf does apply an agency theory, and the Texas cases that don't involve our exact cases all recognize the agency relationship inherent in the unit agreement. I think the common theme in what few cases there are is a recognition of the sanctity of the unit once it's been validly formed and once production has begun. Now, the cases cited in the opinion and the brief of Shepard, to the extent they even involve pooling or a unit, are all distinguishable on one of three grounds. One, they involve a community lease in which the law implies pooling into the lease itself, and therefore when the lease terminates, so does the implication. Or two, they involve cases where the court found that the lessee never had the authority to pool the lessor's interest in this manner in the first place. Or three, they involve units that were never producing. I think the Court of Appeals' refusal to uphold pooling once a lease terminates clashes not only with the law, but also with clear Texas public policy. It's been the policy of this state since at least the 1930s to promote and encourage pooling and unitization as an efficient means of producing minerals while avoiding the waste associated with multiple wells. This court recognized in 1976 in its opinion in Mingdon versus Peninsula Production Company, which is cited at page 23 of our brief, that pooling and unitization are essential to the oil and gas industry and that they benefit both the lessor and the lessee. Today, pooling has become only more common, as Williams and Myers recognizes, and it's become even more vitally necessary given the increasing importance of oil and gas to both our economy and our national security, as well as the increasing difficulty of finding new reserves of oil and gas.
But here, they're not trying to bust the pooled unit, and that's the distinction between this case and Ladd. I mean, they're not trying to – nothing the Court of Appeals said would undermine the public policy that favors unitization.
Well, no, Your Honor, I take exception to that. I think the court's rule is so broad that it would apply to the situation – that could bust a unit. I mean, say, for example, Shepard had owned 100% of the interest in the Shepard Tract, which is the only wells in the unit. The court's rule would have the effect of taking the tract out of the unit altogether, and there would be no production to sustain.
You'd have to drill extra wells. And it'd have to be...
Yes, and assuming that that would be...
The unit would have to drill offset wells and... to get the same oil and gas out.
Well, yes, Your Honor, and that assumes that it would even be economically feasible to do so. Given the circumstances, it may not be that the cost of drilling additional wells on the non-producing tracts, it may be that they would outset the likely production revenues that we could extract from underneath her wells and her tract. I also think that pooling is even more vitally needed today given the increasing fragmentization of mineral interests both in Texas and the United States as a whole since the 1930s.
Does the record show the ownership of the mineral interests in the unit?
All the other interests?
Mm-hmm.
The unit designation and the amended unit designation do list they have a diagram of all the tracts and the lease ownerships. They don't reflect any subsequent assignments or transfers.
Are they related either in the unit or in the Shepard tract? Is there a relationship? I mean, this woman ended up with an eighth of the mineral interest. I just wondered if the other seven-eighths...
were owned by relatives?
Family
or?
Members? Or?
You know, Your Honor, I don't recall off the top of my head that the record does not actively reflect that, and I have not examined the names to determine that. Thank you.
Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Meshes will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, the central question presented in this case is whether a lessee's ongoing pooling rights survive expiration of the lessee's determinable fee interest in the mineral estate. We believe that reversal of the Court of Appeals decision here would upset almost a century of black-letter Texas oil and gas law, holding that upon termination, the entire mineral estate reverts to the lessor under a possibility reverter.
When you say a century, exactly how many Texas cases is that?
Well, we're talking about beginning in 1923 in the Stevenson case and up through pooling. Up through the pool case in 2003.
Oh, one or two cases in the briefs, I think, that actually address this question, right?
What I'm talking about is in terms of the reversion of the fee simple absolute interest, because we believe that's the controlling question in this case, because the pooling rights that are granted under the terms of the lease are part of the property grant, and they are the lessee's rights. And when the fee simple determinable terminates or is extinguished because of failure to pay the royalties, those rights terminate and the fee simple absolute reserve.
But that's, if I've got land and a mobile home on it and I sell it to somebody on finance it myself, and they sell the mobile home while they've got it, and then they stop paying me and title reverts to me, I don't get to go get the mobile home back. They owned it. They sold it while they had title to it. And I do get fee back to the land, but if they've sold something in the meantime, that's gone.
Right, and I think the difference between your example and the situation we have here is really the nature of the oil and gas lease transaction. And that is any rights that are granted to the lessee under the transaction are subject to and arise out of the real property grant. And that's what it is. It's a fee simple determinable, and all the lessee's rights are subject to that grant. And our position is that when the underlying property grant is extinguished, the rights the lessee.
How's that different from my mobile home example?
Well,
if the mobile home's on the property and I sell it, it takes everything with it, and you have whatever authority you have, and you sell stuff in the meantime.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it cancels it and it comes back to me, but it cancels only what's there.
Well, I think the nature of the mineral estate is what makes it a different example.
But that's just different from all other real estate.
Yeah, I think it's a different situation.
That seems to make a lot of sense. Except I get lost here when you have a pooling agreement, which seems to say something else. So yeah, you have two different agreements, and that's. For me, that's what
right.
makes this difficult.
Well, I think right.
Otherwise, it's simple the way you said it.
Right. Well, I think the issue with the two separate agreements is a little bit mischaracterized by the petitioners, because there are two different sets of documents here. We have the lease document and we have the unitization agreement, or the designation of the pooling unit. But the lease itself is more than just a mere contract, and that's where the stump decision from the Ninth Circuit really gets it wrong, because what the lease agreement is a grant of a property rights, a fee simple determinable. And all any contractual rights or other rights that flow from that arrangement are completely tied in with the fee simple determinable estate. And so it's not like
think the lessor could agree going in the lease to the survival of any pooled unit?
I think that the lease in this case, Justice Hegg, actually answers that question. In paragraph 6 of the lease, you'll notice in the handout they cite part of the pooling rights provision. But in paragraph 6 of the lease, it states that the dilution, that is the right to dilute based on the unit agreement, is a right that the lessee has only with respect to the, quote, lessor's royalty. That is, the parties have agreed in this case that right to dilute, that right to bind the property, and this is the only source of that right, is limited to the lessor's royalty. When the party's relationship transformed upon termination of the real property grant, that meant that there's no shepherd status, is not lessor, it's co-tenant, and there's no royalty interest anymore. It is a co-tenancy right of recovery.
Well, what I'm asking just at the outset is, mm-hmm. the lessor could agree otherwise.
It is possible to agree otherwise.
They could cover this whole thing by agreement.
It could be covered by agreement. I think that the language of the lease here, though, answers that question as well. And I think that with respect to the other provisions of the pooling rights provision that Ms. Stokes mentioned, particularly the termination provision, that's a lessee termination right provision. That is, it doesn't preclude termination on some other basis. It's not an exclusive termination provision.
But the lease allows pooling of the leased premises.
That's correct.
Described as the whole, as the real estate.
Right.
As the mineral interest.
Right.
So why isn't that the lessor's interest as well?
The reason why that's not the lessor, that's the lessor's interest up until the time of the termination. But whether you call it lands or leasehold or lease, it's all under the terms of the grant and the way that Texas law has always understood the nature of that grant. It is a real property grant, and those lands, lease, that real property is extinguished. There's no more rights the lessee holds to that property, and its rights granted to it that are subject to the real property grant likewise terminate.
And that approach you're talking about was central to the Court of Appeals, the fact that there's some realty interest that's been conveyed and then terminated. One potential concern with that is, doesn't it cause some lack of stability and may create the possibility of destabilizing a unit when individual lease holders or owners can control or have so great an impact on the unit?
Right. I think there's a couple of thoughts I have about that question. First of all, in this case, we are not dealing with a unit-wide shutdown. Okay, we have, in this case, Shepherd owned a 1/8 mineral interest. The defendants in this case own the remaining.
I assume it was. I mean, it could easily be.
In another case,
your argument would be exactly the same if she owned 8/8.
That's great. It could be in a different.
Would shut everything down.
And
would have to drill other wells.
In that case, that is a different case, and I think our case is different. And I
want people drilling extra, but I know. But
right,
if we're writing a rule for everybody.
Right, I understand that.
And we don't want to write a rule where everybody's got to go back like they were in East Texas. Everybody's got to build a well right on the edge of your property, because otherwise those guys next door will steal it.
Well, and I understand that concern, Justice Brister, but I think the core to this issue in this case is, where are you going to place the responsibility for what has happened here? It's not the lessor's responsibility that the lease terminated. It is the lessee's responsibility. This is a limitation that was, as Ms. Stokes pointed out, was heavily negotiated, and this is a limitation on the lease. In most cases, the reason why a lease will terminate, or a reason why the unit might terminate, would probably be because of cessation of production, and the implications you're talking about would not be drawn out there. This is unique in the sense that it is a royalty-based limitation on the lease. I think the other point I make about the concern that Justice Wainwright raised and you've just raised is that pooling is not sacrosanct under Texas law. There are a number of cases from this court that limits.
It's the public policy favors it over individual production.
That is absolutely correct. But there are some very important cases from this court, going back to the Killingsworth decision, that really outline how the lease can control the nature of pooling, right? And that is the lease that defines the pooling rights provision that defines the scope of the rights. And that's exactly what our argument is here, that the nature of the real property grant controls the scope of the whatever agency or contractual authority that may exist.
See, that's two different things. It's one thing to say parties can set this up however they want to. These are grown-ups. Everybody's got lawyers. They can set this up however they want to. But, of course, there's always cases like this one that they didn't think about.
Right.
But that's a different thing from saying what you're saying is we're going to imply from a theory. I mean, the contracts don't say anywhere pooling evaporates when the lease does, not explicitly.
That is true, but what the contract do say is that the lessee does not have any contractual or any other real property right after the termination, because the provision that I pointed to before in the pooling rights provision specifically says the right to dilute, which is really the issue here. That is, it's how are you going to account as a result of the change in the relationship. The accounting provision applies to the, quote, lessor's royalty. So I think that the lease provision, the provisions of the lease actually answer that aspect of the question.
Counsel, the Court of Appeals said, and I'm reading from it here, the pooling agreement itself expressly transferred only lessee's interest, a determinable fee that ceased when the lease terminated. and it doesn't quote the language on that. Do you have any thoughts on what the Court of Appeals meant when it said it it put that in italics, only transferred only lessee's interest?
Yeah, I think that that's a little I do have an answer what that's about. I mean, it stemmed from a prior statement in the opinion. There's a footnote, I believe it's footnote 5 in the Court of Appeals opinion, discussing the cross-conveyance bar that's in the terms of the lease. And what that provision dealt with was the fact that the royalty interest owners are not transferred. That is, they're not joint ownership of the pooled unit as a result of pooling. What I think the Court of Appeals was referring to is what happens when you pool. That is, the lessee is exercising rights, dominion control, real property control over the minerals when the lease is formed. And I think that's quoted in the language in terms of what the declaration of the unit is, that is bringing together leases and lands and those kinds of things, so bringing together the mineral interest. I don't think that there is a transfer from the lessee to other parties to the unit agreement under the terms of the unit. I don't think that's what occurs here.
All right, well, how about the pooling agreement contracting only for the lessee's interest?
That provision, there actually is not a bar, to my knowledge, there's not a bar on the cross-conveyance, but I don't think it expresses an intent to cross-convey property interest. I think what it is a joining together for production purposes, and then the royalty interests and royalty interest owners have a right, based on the terms of their leases, to production from the unit. So I don't think there's necessarily a property transfer to other parties to the unit.
Okay, so you're still on the lease limiting what can be transferred and not the pooling agreement and what it did transfer.
That's right. Yeah, it's to us, it's the lease.
I have two questions. One, on what the commentary say, because there's not a whole lot of case law on
right.
this. And Ms. Stokes says that it supports more her position than yours. And then the second, and maybe you answered this before, but I'm maybe you can elaborate on what's wrong with the stump court's formulation, the
sure.
Ninth Circuit, because they propose it this way. If A authorizes B to bind him to a contract with C, and B, here, Shepherd, does so, the contract between A and C is not terminated by forfeiture of the original contract between A and B if that agreement was in effect at
right.
the time the contract was with C was signed, if you're following.
Right, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about, Justice.
Okay, so the two, the commentators and then
okay, this. I'll start with the commentators. I completely disagree with the petitioner's view. Kramer Martin says that the evaluates a counterargument, this principal agency argument that's raised in the Stumpf decision, and they say the better view is that the rights granted in the lease to pool expire, they terminate, and they lapse when the lease itself expires. And that's based on the nature of the leasehold interest. They say that basic property law considerations should apply, and the main point they're making is that the right to pool and to maintain pooling is not an additional right that's granted that would extend beyond the terms of the lease. And so I think that the commentators answer back the Stumpf decision and say this agency theory is flawed. Now, as far as the Stumpf decision itself, that decision I think is wrong in a couple of important ways, but I'll begin with it has been a pretty heavily criticized decision because of its determination about the nature of the lease termination. That is, they concluded that the lease did not terminate during the primary term of the lease because there was not proper notice given by the lessor to the lessee. That's a view that's been completely discredited by the leading oil and gas states and authorities. Now, what they used that conclusion to say that the unit agreement at the time of formation, that's how I read that decision, at the time of its designation was properly designated. Remember, that is not the issue in our case, whether or not the unit at the time of its designation was proper. The question is the ongoing pooling rights. Now, the other aspect, I think, of the Stumpf decision that gets it very wrong is I think the agency analysis is flawed because, as I mentioned before, the relationship between A and B in the hypothetical proposed is not merely contractual. It's not merely contractual. It's real property. And any rights that flow from that A-B relationship, or rights that are granted to B under that relationship, are only subject to the real property grant. And when that real property grant is extinguished, those rights, I think, likewise are extinguished as well.
If the lease that terminated had been for a larger interest, it might not be possible to pay royalties to the non-producing tract interests that are in the unit,
mm-hmm.
Out of the operator's interest, right?
I think it could. I think the answer to your question is it does not change what the royalty interest owner's right to royalty is, but I think it could affect what the working interest owners could pay. I think it's possible it could affect what their ability to pay out.
Which is another troubling thing, because the whatever the equities are in this situation, it looks like the lessors in the non-producing part of the unit are completely innocent. I mean, they had nothing to do with any of this.
Right.
So their share, it would seem an odd result that their financial payout should diminish because of what's happened between the operator and one
right operator. But I think actually that in terms of the other lessors, if it became to a situation where there was some kind of need to shut down the unit, or the lessee exercised a right to terminate the unit because it couldn't produce in a way that made economic sense, I think the key thing to keep in mind is those lessors, they would retain a fee simple absolute in their mineral interest. They could enter new leases. They could drill well. There was a self-help aspect of it to the lessor, and so they could maintain potentially some economic benefits as well. So I don't think it's a clear-cut answer to what would happen in that situation.
And if the shoe was on the other foot, if the wells were on the other properties and not on Ms. Shepherd's property.
Right.
And the lease is terminable at will, so they could shut her out.
They could shut her out, and that's
the rule you're arguing for would allow operators to shut people out.
I think
as long as they have a lease like this one, where they can do something to cancel the lease, then they can. Kick out the people in the pool they don't like and keep the people they do.
They can, under this very specific provision, they can definitely do that. I think under...
But you're not troubled by that.
It didn't
happen to you.
Well, I think the way to look at it, a good analogy and a foil for this discussion, is what happened in the Ladd decision, where you had parties to still valid leases attempted to terminate based on production on another, based on the release of a lease on the producing, that is the drill site tract. And what the Court of Appeals said there is you can't terminate the entire unit based on the release of another lease. So I think what I would come back to is that the example that you propose, it may occur in the context of this royalty limitation on the property right, but I think as a general matter you're dealing with a production issue, and it's not a likely recurrent issue, I don't believe. And as far as whether when the shoe's on the other foot, again, there is a co-tenancy right that would flow to well, I guess in this instance, there was a mineral interest that would flow back to Shepherd as a result of termination. So then there are rights that are part of that are very valuable
right,
mineral rights.
If a unit pool falls apart, you can always drill more wells.
Right.
That's why we have pooling.
So
you don't have to drill more wells.
Right. But I think I would point the court to, you know, the nature of this particular case. And I understand the concern about future cases, but I think that it's not clear to me that in a future case that you would necessarily have complete shutdown of well operations. I think there are other advantages that would flow back to the lessors in terms of self-help by drilling their own well or entering into new leases or renegotiating the terms of the leases that are part of the unit. There are a number of options that I think prevent necessarily that result from occurring.
There are statements in the briefs about whether the wells would have been drilled without the unit.
Mm-hmm.
What's the state of the evidence on that?
Well, the state of the evidence to me on that, I think a couple of things. It's not clear to me from the record that you had to drill there was a spacing issue, a well spacing issue. And as a result, that is what the defendants say is the reason why they went ahead and unitized all these tracks together. However, there's also testimony in the record, I believe it's from the cross-examination of Wagner Brown's witness, Omar Brown, and there were questions directed to him about seeking an exception under Rule 37 to the Railroad Commission. And I think in this case, particularly if you look at the interest, that was an available option to the lessee, to the working interest owner. They could have gone to the Railroad Commission, because the only parties with standing to object, as far as I can tell from the record, would be the working interest owners, and that's all the defense in this case. So I don't think it was necessary. And I don't think it's clear that the second well, from the record, I'm not sure if the second well was needed to create the second amount of production. I'm not sure about the state of the evidence as far as that's concerned.
But if wells would not have been drilled without the unitization, that seems to augur in favor of
maintaining the unit even after the one of the leases expires.
Right. I think that the issue about benefits of pooling, because it goes to what their view about this estoppel idea and effect on unit. In this case, I think it's very important to understand these are drill site tracks. And the second well has been responsible for less than 20% of the overall production. The Landers number one has been the lion's share, and those numbers are detailed in the judgment. So the benefits to pooling in this case are not as clear as, for example, in the lab case, where the lessors who sought to terminate the entire unit were benefiting entirely from production on another track. And so I think that there's a clear difference between those kind of situations. Any further questions from the court?
Are there any further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor, a couple of points. Justice Hecht, when you asked about the evidence on the wells being drilled based on the unit, Omer Brown, Wagner Brown's division land manager, testified clearly that these wells were drilled because of the unit, that under the spacing regulations of the Railroad Commission, we needed a unit. He said on cross, in response to a question from Mr. Holman, could Shepherd have sought an exception if she wanted to drill these two wells? And he said, yes, she could have, but production would have been capped. We would not have had the same revenues from production that we do have on this case. There's no assurance that an exception would have been granted. And ultimately, the woulda, coulda, shoulda of what could have been done doesn't change the fact that these wells were drilled in reliance on the unit. Mr. Meshes talks about the second well being drilled, but it's undisputed that at the time the lease terminated, nobody realized it. It was inadvertent that she wasn't paid royalties within the 120 days, so they didn't realize that it had terminated. Justice Hecht, you also asked about the effect on the other unit holders if she had owned the entire interest in the producing tract. I think one of the pernicious problems with the Court of Appeals rule is that we don't know what the exact effects would be on everyone else until that case gets filed, tried, and decided. But the possibilities are all negative. The possibility that the other unit holders who committed their tracts to this unit and who paid their share of production of the two wells on her property now receive nothing, no share of production. Another possibility is that the producer, a court would hold the producer to the terms of the unit agreement and force it to pay shares to all the other unit holders when it's not receiving a single dime from the tract. In those situations, obviously the unit would become completely uneconomical to the producer, and either way we were destroying the benefits and the bargain benefits of the unit to either the unit holders or the producer lessee. Justice Hecht, I did confirm that the other interest owners in the Shepherd Tract are not related to Ms. Shepherd. Mr. Meshes also talked about these cases such as Stevenson, about the burdens on the lessee's interest automatically disappear when the lessee's interest reverts to the lessor at the termination of the lease. Now, those cases, none of them involve units, but they also involve assignments or carve-outs of the lessee's interest, which the lessee is entitled to do even without a provision in the lease. It's fee determinable interest to do with as it's wished. They do not involve a separate contract that the lessee was authorized to enter into as the lessor's agent, which is a completely different circumstance. And I also think it's interesting that now they are focusing on the commitment of the royalty to the unit agreement when all along they've been ignoring that. And Justice Johnson, the Court of Appeals, I think, was confused when they said that it's the lessee's interest that's transferred. And the anti-cross-conveyance provision doesn't explain that holding, because that provision provides that neither party's interest would be transferred or conveyed in a pooling. So I think the court was simply confused, and it cited Ladd for that proposition, but Ladd said that the purpose of a unit agreement is to commit the lessor's royalty interest.
So your position is that it's the pooling agreement. The opposing counsel says the lease agreement is what governs and keeps it. And your position is it's the pooling agreement we should look at?
No, Your Honor. I think we should look at both of them and look at the terms of both of them and enforce them as written. I think that the lease agreement makes clear that she's committing her lands just broadly, her lands and any interest therein, which would include her royalty, her possibility of revert, or what have you. Under Texas law, that makes CW Resources her agent to sign the unit agreement, and she's bound by the terms of the unit agreement. So I think we can enforce both contracts.
If the lease agreement and the pooling agreement between them specifically cover this matter, does that limit us in using some equitable theory such as estoppel type theory or something to keep the unit together? Under the commentators, they say, well, if the lessee, I mean, or if the lessor has received a benefit, we don't want to break it apart. Right. You have to look at these situations to see if a benefit has been received. But that sounds like an equitable type process. And that is that in conflict with this when we have specific language in the contract?
Your Honor, I don't think they're in conflict. I think that we can enforce the agreements as written that could contractually commit her land to the unit for as long as production continues. Undisputed production has been continuous since inception. And that the commentaries statement about looking at the circumstances that it's still producing and receiving the benefits just buttresses that conclusion. But I don't think it requires you to ignore that. You enforce the terms, and that just the fact that you're also promoting unitization and pooling as you should under your precedent is just extra support for that proposition.
And in your view, if that were the case, the lessor here would continue to be paid as if the lease had not expired?
No, Your Honor. We pay her her co-tenant's interest, which is a full which is a pooled 1/8 as opposed to a pooled 1/4 of a 1/8. She was only getting a 1/32nd share as a royalty, so she will get the 1/8, but it would be
diluted by the pool.
Exactly, Your Honor. Yes. Let's see. Unless the court has any other questions, I will get back the remainder of my time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Counselor. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.